We, Baruch Hashem, are best with two very special speakers. Rav Adlerstein will be coming later. Rav Ari Kahn, I just met tonight, but I have to tell him we have a very early connection because every time I give a drasha and shul, somebody says, oh, I read something by Rav Ari Kahn on this. And Rav Ari Kahn is saying about that. I said, I have to hear it firsthand. So our community immensely appreciates your effort to come on a cold winter evening and give a shiur in our community. I'm sure we'll very much enjoy your words of Torah. Kilat Musar Avicha welcomes everyone. There's an opportunity to add Torah to our Anglican community of all of Malei Adumim. So I'd like to invite Rabbi Kahn to start a shiur. Everybody please rise.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome, warm introduction. So the way that I phrase the title is Elu Ve'elu of postmodern concepts. So there's a couple of assumptions that I have within this title. One is that you have a clue what Elu Ve'elu means, and the other is that you have a clue what postmodern means. So if you don't know what either of those concepts mean, then I assume that you're here early for the second speaker. I remember on a number of occasions, without going into specifics right now, of discussing certain aspects of Judaism with people who are not necessarily what I would call orthodox, whatever that may mean. And one of the favorite phrases that kept coming out again and again as a defense, for I guess for anything or everything, was the phrase of Elu Elu Divkim Chaim, which means that Elu Elu essentially means that you can have license to do anything or have any interpretation. I mean, it was interesting that in terms of the introduction, when you were speaking about the concept of different people can learn and different souls and different connections, but is therefore by extension every single mind that reads any single verse, that reads any single Gemara, that reads any single halacha, is every single conclusion going to have equal validity? Is, when it comes down to Torah, is everything essentially, I don't want to reduce it to saying that everything is the same, but if I do have a concept of Elu Ve'elu Divkim Chaim, so then can I just say that essentially anything and everything which we say is therefore included in Torah? So is that true on a de facto level, or is that true perhaps even on the original level of how Torah was given? So I'm going to pause here for a moment, and we're going to learn the Gemara together, and we're going to spend a little bit of time learning some of the Rishonim, and then maybe go back to some of the original sources, and we'll see how much time we actually have. The idea of Elu Ve'elu Divkim Chaim, or the phrase even, is written in the Talmud Bavli in two places. For an idea which is only written in two places, it's received an incredible amount of traction in terms of the amount of times, the amount of places that it's going to be utilized, cited, and interpreted, and sometimes, I suspect, misinterpreted. But before I go any further, do we have any idea what postmodernism is? So that's excellent. Okay, so no is a good, quick answer. Well, there's actually part of being postmodern is you can have different interpretations of what postmodern means. Part of the problem will be, you know, when you discuss things with people, language is essentially what we have. And if we can't agree what terms mean, we're going to have a hard time discussing things. What postmodernism has done is it essentially shechted the sacred cow, and it has said that different interpretations of different things have equal validity, which means in a certain sense, the way that certain people want to understand Elu Ve'elu is very much a postmodern idea. With enough introductions, let's learn, and as we move on, I'll try to explain. If you do have questions along the way, please feel free to ask. I probably will ignore you, but no. Feel free to ask. The Gemara in Erevin on Daf Yud Gimel Amud Bet says, Amar Rabbi Abba Amar Shmuel. So we have a tradition here which is being introduced in Bavel, second generation of the Amoraim. Amar Rabbi Abba Amar Shmuel. Shalosh Shanim Nechlaku Beit Shammai U Beit Hillel. The schools of Shammai and the schools of Hillel argued for 3 years. Halalu Amrim, one side said, Halacha Kimotenu, the laws according to us. The Halalu Amrim, the other side said, Halacha Kimotenu, the laws according to us. Yatzta bat kol v'amra lahem, a voice comes out of heaven, rings out and says to them, incidentally, those of you who know the Bavli by heart may realize that I've misquoted something already along the way. I'm generally following the text of the Ein Yaakov, which is not 100% the same as the text as the Vilna Shas. If you didn't notice, then I apologize for my apology. A voice comes out and says, the question says to them, or lahem, I believe is extra, comes out and says, Elu ve'elu, divrei Elokim chayim heim, these and these are the words of the living God, v'halacha kedivrei Beit Hillel, and the law is according to the school of Hillel. So now there's a couple of questions that should emerge. One is, did anybody notice what they were arguing about? So if you didn't notice, that's very good, because the Gemara didn't tell us. Which itself is interesting. Do they argue about one particular thing, or do they argue about everything? In this particular case, do they argue about one thing, or do they argue about everything? Answer is, we don't know. That's already going to be subject of interpretation. Second thing is, why did it take them so long? Why did it take them 3 years? Or, for that matter, why even after 3 years were they unable to get to any other resolution? Why in this particular case, of every single argument that ever took place in the history of the Gemara, why over here does a voice come out and say, not just does a voice come out, why over here is there a batkol that says, Elu ve'elu v'divlu kimchayim? For that matter, what exactly does the phrase mean and what are its parameters? And more than that, is it even possible? So let me pause for a moment. And there's finally a last question, which I don't know if we're going to get up to, which is the one question of all the ones that I've asked, which the Gemara actually asks, is this last question. The Gemara is going to ask, well, if both Elu ve'elu divlikim chayim, then why is a law like Beit Hillel? Why is Beit Hillel any better than Beit Shammai? And that the Gemara offers an answer, and that I also question whether we'll get to. But for us, for our purposes, I want to read a question which is cited in the Ritva. The question, first I'll say it and then we'll look at it inside. The Ritva wants to know, and the Ritva is an authority who lived in Spain, he wants to know, how is it possible that Elu ve'elu divlikim chayim? Which means, can there really be multiple truths? Which one is true? How is it possible that a voice says that these and these, Elu ve'elu divlikim chayim? When God gave us the Torah, did he give us the Torah and tell us truth? Or I can then go back and say, no, there's multiple truths. And if there are multiple truths, then the follow-up question will be, what are the parameters of these multiple truths? Or for that matter, is everything equally true? Which means, again, just because the Chazon Ish said something and I disagree with the Chazon Ish, are we on equal stature? Or for that matter, can I argue with, forget about a significant Achron, can I argue with a Rishon? Or you want to go back a little bit further? Can I argue with a Tano? Can I argue with an Amora? Can I argue with Moshe Rabbeinu? Elu ve'elu divlikim chayim. Again, what are the parameters over here? Or it's really going to be quite important. Let's read the way the Ritva asks the question. Elu ve'elu divlikim chayim. Shalu Rabbeinu Tzerfat. The rabbis from France ask. So who are the rabbis from France? Rashi, Tosfot, say there. So part of what we're going to do is I will reveal to you who is the particular rabbi from France that they're talking about, which, as simple as that is what we're going to see today, I do not recall anybody speaking or writing about this topic who has done that. To tell us exactly who this rabbi is and what it is that he said, so give me a little bit of time and we will get there. So at least we're going to get something out of this, I hope. Shalur Benu Tzerfat. How is it possible to have Elu ve'elu? One says it's not allowed, one says it is allowed. Now again, this should be a little bit cause for frustration because we have no idea what they argued about. There's an assumption over here. They argued about certain laws, and if they said laws, then one said good, one said bad, one said kosher, one said not kosher, and I can keep on going down the line what the theoretical argument is about. But if, again, can I make up a case? Pork. Did one rabbi say it's kosher, one rabbi say it's not kosher? Now you're all shaking your head and saying, no, why not? Okay. That's it? It's in the Torah? We can't get past that? Of course we can get past that. So hold on for a second, because I know that I gave an absurd example. The only question is, my example going to be absurd when we continue to read some of the Rishonim? Maybe my example's not going to be so absurd. And he asks again, how could it be Elu Ve'elu? One says it's not allowed, one says it is allowed. V'tirtzu, and they answered, the rabbis from France did, Ki kashala Moshe l'maron, when Moshe went up. Now, those of you that have some sensitivity, hopefully, realize that this is not the Rabbeinu Tzafat theorizing what happened. They're citing sources now about what happened when Moshe received the Torah, which means now we've gone on from how do we paskin halacha, and we've moved back a little bit to the very nature of what it is that God said to Moshe. Ki sha'ala Moshe l'maron l'kabel ha'Torah, when Moshe went up to receive the Torah, hir'elo kol davar v'davar, regarding every single thing God showed him, 49 reasons or aspects why this particular thing is not allowed, why it's prohibited. And God showed him 49 reasons why this thing is allowed. Now, I just want to pause there for a second. You still don't like my example of pork? If God taught every single thing why it's allowed and not allowed, why are you willing to not include that as my example? Again, what's your example going to be? Okay, so now the question is, what is a chazir? So we can still argue what a chazir is. But what does this mean when it says that God gave 49 opinions on every single point, why it's allowed and why it's not allowed? And again, I'm just throwing out this question. How does anybody here know where you put the parameters and what is acceptable and what's not acceptable? And let me say it a little differently. On face value, what we just now read was the most postmodern description of halacha imaginable. Because what did it just now tell us? That every single thing that you can imagine in halacha has a source for it. Both yes and both no, both allowed or both not allowed, it was all taught. And what is the source for this? That's what God taught Moshe. Now, I hope that some of you find this disturbing. Okay, what's the upside of this? The upside of this is you can never challenge your rabbi again. The question is, he right or is he not right? Because anything your rabbi ever says, God said to Moshe at Sinai. What's the disadvantage of this? That anything that anybody ever said, God said to Moshe at Sinai. Which means we've just now reduced halacha into something which is almost meaningless. And I'll say it, now there's no language anymore. Good, bad, right, wrong, it's all meaningless at this point, because everything is yes and no. Everything is fine and not fine. Everything is kosher and everything's not kosher. Everything's allowed and everything is not allowed. And do you realize the world that we can create with this? If you don't, then Baruch Hashem, and you're holier than I am. But this is license for absurdity. Am I overstating my argument right now? You understand what this says. Now, also, at this point, maybe everybody's right, the way that they always cite Elu Ve'elu, because that seems to be what the Ritva is telling us from the Balei Tosfot. So a couple things I want to be careful about. One is the continuation. V'shol HaKadosh Baruch Hu Alzeh. The person who had total confusion about this was Moshe himself. And he says, God, okay, so what do we do? The sages in every generation. Okay, so now we just cut out a lot of people. Not everybody is a sage. Now we have to define who is a sage and who has the right to an opinion. And maybe not everybody has the right to opinion. So we've limited it, but we still have a problem. I hope you all recognize that. We've limited the scope of the problem, but the problem is still going to exist. And notice the way it says here, in every generation they'll decide. And then the Ritva himself tells us he does not love this. How do I know that? Listen to his conclusion. V'nachon hu l'fi hadrash. By the way, for a lot of people, that's a line which is totally insulting. Ze yafeh. Ze drash yafeh. What does that mean when somebody says that? You have to be very careful, because v'nachon l'fi hadrash, that's a very nice idea. U'v'derech ha'emet, which very often is a euphemism, especially for the Ritva who comes from the school of the Ramban, uv'derech emet, Kabbalistically or in terms of the essence of the matter, yesh tam sod b'davar. There's a mystical secret over here, which means the Ritva said it's nice, but this is not really what's going on over here, so I'm just pointing out the Ritva himself doesn't completely love this. Now, Where did these Rabbanei Tzarfat get this idea from? So most likely, and here's where, again, we're going to be careful along the way, is the source of number three, and that is the Midrash Tehillim. Amar Rav Yanai. Rav Yanai said, Lo nina divrei Torah chatichin. The Torah was not given with clearly defined pieces, as it were. El al kol dibur shehaya omer kodesh baruch hu l'moshe. Every single matter which God said to Moshe, haya omer arbim v'teisha panim tameh, tahor v'arbim v'teisha panim tameh. Every single thing that was taught with 49 aspects of being allowed or not allowed, kosher, not kosher, pure, impure. Amul lefanav ribono shel olam, ad matay namod al birosh shel davar. So Moshe says, how in the world do I know what to do? What do I go tell the people? Shabbat, you can work, you can't work. Again, that's what the source says. Pork, kosher, not kosher. Basav v'chalav, good, not good. Amr Leh, God answered and said, Achirei rabim lahatot, you follow the majority. It's very interesting, because the Ritva left that out, or at least the Ritva, perhaps quoting from the Baalei HaTosfot, left that out. Would that be an important line to add in, following the majority? It would be an important line, and the question now would be, what exactly are the parameters of a majority, and who gets a vote? This is far more complicated than you perhaps realize. There is a mitzvah in the Torah to follow the majority, which is most likely, according to what I can tell, most Rishonim, although based on Elu, you can argue with me now, is something which exists within a court. So therefore, you have a beit din of three people, two say yes, one say no, you follow the two. But where it's really important is actually in the Sanhedrin. In the Sanhedrin, they will decide law, and the law of the Sanhedrin will be in accordance with the majority. When I decide a halacha today, yes, people occasionally will ask me questions. When somebody asks me a question on halacha, am I obligated to give them the answer which most rabbis say, or am I not obligated to do that? There are poskim who will give you the impression that that is the way you decide halacha, by following the majority. Most of those who do that, I would call it aesthetics of halacha, but not substance of halacha. Which means the Beit Yosef makes believe he does that. And I apologize for using the word make believe, because he'll say, no, we follow the majority, and then he'll tell you who he uses as a majority, but there are the people he doesn't use at all, so therefore there's an aesthetic over here. Rav Avadi Yosef, and I have not studied every tshuva he wrote, but when he writes his tshuvot, he'll always give you, I say always, I'm trying to be careful, but he'll always give you more side on the side that he's going to rule. But you always get the sense with Rav Avadia, if he wanted, he could have added seven more people on the other side. So again, is it really that when we decide halacha, we follow the majority? I can assure you that many, 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 if not all, Ashkenazic poskim don't follow that approach. After the Beit Yosef, the Mechaber goes and gives you all the majority who says this, again, using a certain group of people, the Rama responds, but this is our custom. Completely unimpressed with the majority, this is our custom. But moreover, there's a greater problem. The problem is, how do you count people? Meaning, we have conflicting halachic principles which may be at hand. Let's just say a majority of people in 1920 saw something in a particular way. But then, in 1950, rabbis rejected the majority from 1920. Do they have a right to do that? That was the majority. And let's just say, for example, the rabbis who argue, or later rabbis, who saw all the earlier arguments, but they're not impressed by the earlier arguments, and they choose to reject the earlier arguments. We have a principle, halacha kebatrai. We have a principle that the later person who looks at the earlier information, their opinion counts. And for that matter, do you ever count people as a majority if they never sat together in a room with a minority? If you never had a chance to discuss something, is that considered a majority? Just because a lot of people say something doesn't make it a majority, which means, again, the classic case of a majority is when they sat in a court. When they sat in a court, there was deliberations, and each side brought all the arguments. So the fact that 80% of rabbis have a certain approach to halacha, and 20% disagree, am I today obligated to go after that 80%? Absolutely not. Could be that unimpressed with the arguments of the 80%. It could be far more impressed with the arguments of the 20%. I mean, on top of that, there will be other considerations. I'll just throw out one more. If you look at the true vote of Rav Moshe Feinstein, completely different approach than you'll see from Rav Avadia, who's counting and trying to get the majority. And Rav Avadia's really trying to figure out what the Shulchan Aruch had to say about something, what Rav Yosef Karo had to say about something, or Rav Moshe Feinstein's trying to figure out what the Gemara had to say about something, which means their points of reference are completely different. Rav Moshe wants to know, what does the Gemara say about it? And therefore, as far as what he understands, the conclusion of the Gemara is halacha. While for somebody else, it could be that what's halacha, what the Rambam says. For somebody else, halacha could be what the Shulchan Aruch says. And for somebody else, halacha could be what the common practice is. Which means the word halacha, now we're back to elu ve'elu. But my point is that over here, it actually said in the Midrash Tehillim, follow majority. Follow majority is a wonderful solution when? As long as we have a quorum. If you don't have a quorum, you're going to run into a problem. Which leads me to what exactly happened with Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. So before we go any further, let me just note something. Why couldn't Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai work it out? Why couldn't they together come to a conclusion? Okay, I'm going to leave that question open, let you think about that a little bit, and let me continue a step further. In source number 4, there is somebody known as Rabbeinu Peretz. So who do you think wrote the it's called Tosfot Rabbeinu Peretz. So who do you think wrote Tosfot Rabbeinu Peretz? You feel there's a trick question, right? His students, right? It's the students of Rabbeinu Peretz. So Rabbeinu Peretz was a student of Rabbi Yechiel from Paris, Rabbi Yechiel mi Paris, and we're going to learn now who the rabbis from France were. And now you can already guess, especially if somebody's name is Rabbi Yechiel from Paris, that may be a big hint. So let's read. Source number 4, Eil Veil Divadum Chaim. V'im Tom Regabi Isser Veheter, regarding something which is kosher. Yoredeya, what we would call it, they called it Issa V'Heter then, regarding Issa V'Heter, which was my example from the beginning, pork. I know you didn't like that example. He's asking my question. Regarding Issa V'Heter, Hechi Shaych Lomer, Eilva Yodiv L'Kem Chayim. How can you say this when it comes to certain areas? Im Hu Asur, Einu Mutar. V'Im Hu Mutar, Einu Asur. Which means, how can you say elu ve'elu by something which God said is either allowed or not allowed? What right do you have to say something? How is elu ve'elu even possible? Ve'omer mi Rabbeinu Peretz, what's the next two letters? Nishmato Eden, may his soul rest in peace in the Garden of Eden. So now you know it's the students of Rabbeinu Peretz citing Rabbeinu Peretz. D'matze b'tosfot Rabbeinu Yechiel, he found a source which was in Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, the Itab Midrash, quoting the Midrash that I just now read for you, Midrash Tehillim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shana HaTorah LeMoshe Ba'arba'im V'Tesha Panim Mutar, Ba'arba'im V'Tesha Panim Asur. That's how God taught it. 49 aspects of allowed and not allowed. HaMoshe LaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ma'ase. That was a wonderful lesson. Now what do we do? Amar Lei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Halach Achar Rov Chachmei Hador. Im Rov Chachmei Hador Maskimim Leheter, Yeh Mutar. If most say allowed, it's allowed. And this is very interesting, because the way that the Ritva cites Rabbeinu Peretz citing Rabbeinu Bechiel, he left out this point of the majority, which actually was in the Midrash. And if he would have used this point of majority, then our question would come up all over again. So why couldn't the schools of Hillel and Shammai work this out in terms of the majority? Why did this go on for 3 years? Why did anybody ever have an idea? Okay, let's put this to a vote and let's decide. Ubikom makom kashem imasim shekfar hayu. Rabbeinu Peretz, what does he say? I believe this is Rabbeinu Peretz now. It's no longer Rabbeinu Yechiel. It's Rabbeinu Yechiel. If it is Rabbeinu Yechiel at this point, now what do you think, Rabbi? Don't want to put you on the spot. Put you on the spot. Nachum, what do you say? Sounds like it. That's what it sounds like to me. That's how I read it. But if it is, in fact, Rabbeinu Peretz saying this, sorry, let's just say for a second Rabbeinu Yechiel saying it, then he himself rejects the pshat that the Ritva quotes from the Tosfot. If it's Rabbeinu Peretz, he's saying, that's a wonderful interpretation. How does this help by all the arguments that take place in the Gemara regarding something that was? Either it was this or it was this way. How can you say? And incidentally, the other case of Eilu Ve'Eilu with the Gemara is about something that was. Nonetheless, the Gemara will find a way of saying that both of them were, that both of them happened, in fact. Okay. Kigon mizbeach dechad muchach mikra, dehaya shishin, dechad muchach mikra, dehaya esrim. It can't be both. The hotem hech shaykh lomer, el chayim. You can't have people voting for what was reality. It just doesn't work. So essentially, Rabbeinu Peretz himself is rejecting this interpretation. It was only one of them is actually factual. And he says the reality is by all these things, God only taught one thing. Which means he just now completely rejected this Midrash Tehillim as well. God only taught one. God taught Moshe Torah. God did not teach Moshe confusion. Rather, there are certain cases that you can make an argument based upon a verse that I could understand it in one direction and certain things I can understand in another direction. So essentially, the Rabbeinu Peretz comes to the conclusion that there is no postmodern concept of Elu V'Elu. Elu V'Elu was not that God taught everything. Elu V'Elu is actually a concept. It is a tool which is used by rabbis subsequent in order to try to interpret and understand halacha. Actually, I want to say something which may clarify this incredibly. And I had a thought about this many, many years ago. And it wasn't until I saw something from Rav Lichtenstein that I realized that somebody actually agreed with me. Because I just thought I was saying something that maybe was complicated. How do you translate the phrase Eilu v'Eilu divkum chayim in English? So when I read it the first time, I translated it as these and these are the words of the living God. And that's the problem. Because if these and these are the words of the living God, that means that God said both. If God said both, then why does God say things that are contradictory? Which means the Batkal comes out and says regarding Hillel, regarding Shammai, sorry, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, Eilu v'Eilu divkum chayim. God said both of these things. So if God said two contradictory things, the problem was God. And we go back to this problem or the solution. Okay, God said kosher, not kosher, which leads us to an absurdity. So I suspected that that was not the correct interpretation of the words. I suspected that it was a misinterpretation. The correct way of interpreting it is something else completely, which would be Eilu v'Eilu divkum chayim would instead mean not these and these are the words of the living God. Rather, these and these are the living words of God. So then I found in a book which is called Leaves of Faith, one of the collected writings of Lichtenstein, volume 1 on page 65, Rav Lichtenstein, who knew English quite well, if those of you knew him. When I heard him speak in Hebrew, I thought, okay, I don't understand him because he's speaking in Hebrew. And then I heard him speak in English, and I said, okay, this is not working. So he translated this. Those of you who don't know, by the way, he happened to have a PhD in English literature from Harvard. So yes, he actually did know English, and he has the degree to prove it, okay? So he writes as follows, the statements of both are living words of God. Which is, I'm saying, it's exactly what I had felt, again, for many years, that was an exact interpretation. In a footnote, he then writes, this is footnote 15 on page 85, he writes, however, in our context, I intuit that the referent is Divrei, and I've translated accordingly. So if that helped any of you, then very good. Which means the phrase, I mean, the whole problem of the Ritva just now disappeared. Do you realize that? It's God never said both things. God never said, these and these are the words of the living God, because if both words of God, that means they both have to be true, because how could the word of God not be true? But if instead it means these and these are living words of God, do you realize that's exactly what we just now read in Rabbeinu Peretz? It wasn't that God said both, it's rather that God's words can be applied in different circumstances by using this verse and applying it one way or using this verse and applying it another way. It's applications of law moving forward rather than describing a reality which took place when God actually gave the Torah. Yes, which means rabbis can differ when they make applications of law, but that doesn't mean that both are true. That doesn't mean that God said both. It means that rabbis perhaps have license even to have wrong interpretations. Rabbis have license to give wrong interpretations, and they don't necessarily have license to give every wrong interpretation, because there may actually be limits to that as well. Just in case you're interested, when I asked, you know, which rabbis from France, so somebody said the most famous rabbi from France, which was Rashi. So Rashi, we actually know what he says about this, and this is Rashi, which is Gemara Ketuvot and Daf Nun Zayin, which very conveniently is in source number 5. Where Rashi writes, look at the very end of the Rashi, which again, intellectual honesty would dictate we read the whole thing, but you have time for intellectual honesty later, not now. The Ikala Memer, Eilu v'Eilu divkum chayim heim, zimnim d'shayach haytama, v'zimnim d'shayach haytama, shahatam mitapech lafi shinoi hadvarim b'shinoi mu'at. That when you apply Jewish law, The different circumstance can change the law ever so slightly, which means he understands Eilu ve'Eilu as applications of law, but not as far as a reality, as far as what God actually said. And as, again, I think this is quite significant, because if you think about it, now you'll realize what Rashi said here is really what Rabbeinu Peretz said, and the concept that God said multiple truths is really quite difficult. Which means, what is our problem now, if we do have one? Our problem is not really the Ritva, because he didn't love it. It's not Rabbeinu Peretz, because he certainly didn't like it. It's not Rashi, because he didn't agree with this at all. Maybe our problem now goes back and is actually the Midrash Tehillim, which is not completely the problem, because the Midrash Tehillim itself said there is a way of resolving this and following the majority, but nonetheless, what did God actually teach? So I want to go one step further, and this is in source number 6. Now, source number 6 is generally not discussed within the whole... Well, it's actually 6 and 7, because they go together. They're generally not discussed when people speak about Eilu ve'Eilu, because it doesn't obviously speak about Eilu ve'Eilu. But you'll realize very quickly why I'm bringing it in. And that is because this source tells us what Rabbi Yannai said. Who's Rabbi Yannai? He was the one, the author in the Midrash Tehillim. Rabbi Yannai is the one who was brought in, again, arguably by Rabbeinu Yechiel of Paris, into this whole discussion. But we have, and I'm being a little careful now, a more authoritative source. You like the way I say that with authority? A more authoritative source. Why do I call it a more authoritative source? Because it's Talmud Yerushalmi. A Talmud Yerushalmi has more authority regarding a tradition, not in terms of the Bavli, but has more authority in terms of a Midrash and Tehillim. This is a Talmud. So if we look at number 6, we're going to find something interesting. I'm Rabbi Yannai. Ilu nina Torah chatucha lo ita l'regel amida matam ve'deber shel Moshe amar lefanav ribonu shalom hodi'enu hechi halacha. God, please tell me what's law. Amar lo acherabim l'hatot. What's law? Follow the majority. Rabu hamazakin ziku. Rabu hamachayvim chivu. Kedei shi ha-Torah nidreshet abrim v'teisha panim tamei v'rim v'teisha panim tor minayin u'diglu. So I just want to pause a second. The difference between the way that Rabbi Yannai is reported in the Yerushalmi versus the way it was reported in the Midrash Tehillim. In the Midrash Tehillim, it said that God taught 49 levels of each. Over here, it says that the rabbis will often apply it in 49 different levels. That's very different, because what is it moving away from? The possibility that God taught us contradictory ideas in terms of Torah. The Yerushalmi didn't say that. The Yerushalmi says that God gave us Torah, we follow the majority, because rabbis will make applications of law. Again, I want to be very clear about this. There are certain questions, and right away when I use my pork example, you disagreed with me, and you were right for disagreeing with me, because we can't argue about pork. You can't, and we'll see more about this in a moment. You can't argue about that. But there are other things we can argue about. Just for example, if somebody took the DNA of pork and made some food out of that DNA in terms of using the molecules and so on, so now we could begin to argue with that. Is that included or is it not included? And one rabbi is going to make a drasha and make this application of law, and someone else is going to make that kind of application of law. Now that's completely different, because that's not God saying that pork is kosher or not kosher at one time, confusing Moshe. Rather, and this is the Yerushalmi saying, is that there's going to be certain things of law, follow the majority, because new cases are going to arise, and then people are going to make applications of law coming to opposite conclusions. Okay? So I'm just saying the 49 levels of law in either direction is utilized very differently over here. In source number 7, which is the Yerushalmi in the same place, more or less, Ketzad danim hasheretz. What's the law regarding the sheretz? I'm Rabbi Yannai, which is very interesting because what's following now is again from Rabbi Yannai. It comes out of a Rebbe. Talmud v'tikayelo Rav Meir. Rav Meir had a old established student. V'hoyi metaheret hasheretz mitam'o mea pa'amim. He figured out 100 different ways of allowing, saying it's pure and saying it's impure regarding the sheretz. Umrin, what was the conclusion of the Yerushalmi regarding such a person? Ahu talmida lo have yodo moraya. Such a person has no idea how to paskin halacha. Why does he not know how to paskin halacha? Because he came to a conclusion that a sheretz is tahor. That's very interesting. Because what did it just now do? It just now set limitations. If you, through your Talmudic brilliance, come to a conclusion that pork is kosher, you can't paskin halacha. You know why? It could be you're very clever. It could be you figured out all kinds of things, but there's one thing you haven't figured out, and that is how to paskan halacha, because there are certain rules. It goes a little bit further, and it says over here, Amar Rav Yaakov Bir Desai, Dohu Tamida Katua Mitura Desinai Hava. Such a student is cut off from her Sinai. Normally we talk about halacha. What do we call it? Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. The Torah has its authority going all the way back to Moshe at Sinai. Somebody who comes to an absurd conclusion saying that something which is not kosher is kosher, and by the way, the other way around as well, such a person can't paskin halacha, and such a person is severed from Sinai. This is not a true tradition, which means when you read the Rabbani teaching in the Yerushalmi, it's absolutely different from the Rabbani teaching in Midrash Tehillim. Because the Midrash Tehillim led us to this conclusion, yeah, God taught Moshe contradictory materials, 49 levels this way, 49 levels this way, everything is kosher, everything's not kosher, everything's allowed, everything's not allowed, which means everything is negotiable, everything is debatable, every single aspect of Judaism is subject to yes, no, yes, no. And there is no, again, every single halacha from the beginning of Aruch Chaim, the end of Chosha Mishpat, every single law becomes negotiable according to that Midrash and Tehillim. But when you look in the Yerushalmi, it says, no, there are limits. The whole idea of 49 levels is not telling us what happened in the past. It's telling us how people make applications as we move forward to new cases. And if somebody comes up with a conclusion which is wrong, and now I'm sorry, I just made a value judgment, so I absolutely apologize. But is there such a thing as right or wrong? Well, by the way, sometimes in a postmodern world there isn't, unless you say there's no such thing as right or wrong, then you're wrong. But over here, there are things that are wrong. There are some things which objectively are not correct. And if somebody comes to the conclusion that the pork is kosher, somebody comes to the conclusion that, and I can go down through every single area of law, things which are not allowed, they claim is allowed. That person, you say, it's very clever, but that person cannot paskin halacha, and that person is severed from Sinai. This is not Sinai. This is not a true application of law, because there are limits to the application of law, and that's what I get out of this Yerushalmi. And I'll say this as well. Within the various discussions of Elu, I've never seen anybody quote this Yerushalmi, which now you say, that's absurd. How can nobody quote this? This is just so obvious in setting the parameters. But nonetheless, anything which is in Yerushalmi tends to be seen as esoteric and therefore is not always cited. But let's go back for a second to try to put together our passage, because it's still broken. Why do I say it's still broken? Because why did the school of Hillel and Shammai argue for 3 years? Why did God say, Elu ve'elu divilikim chayim? And what exactly does that mean? And ultimately, why does God say the law is like Hillel and why not like Shammai? So I do want to try to answer as many of those as I can, and I will have time for questions. If you have no questions, then I'll just leave. So, we learned from various sources that Hillel and Shammai had different educational approaches. In source number 12, when it says, by Anshe Knesset Agdola, V'hamidu tamidim harbe, I'm citing here from Avot Rabbi Natan, which is a brayta on Pirkei Avot. Here it says, Shebeit Shammai Yomar, Al Yishane Adam El Mishahu Chacham, Va'anav, Uben Avot, Va'ashir. That Beit Shammai was limited in who they're willing to teach. Ubeit Hillelom, Rim Lakol Adam Yishane, Sheharbei Poshim Hayu Bahem Biyisrov, and it Karvula Tamut Tarav, Yitzumem Tzadikim, Chasidim, Ukshirim. We read over here in this source a fundamental argument regarding who they were willing to teach. The one thing that some of you may find disturbing is that it said Ashir, that he would only teach the wealthy people. And in case you're disturbed, it's okay. There are jobs today as well that you cannot get unless you're wealthy and somebody's supporting you, and you can do that. I won't get in modern Israel and modern America and other places as well. A person can't possibly afford to go into that line of business. I won't qualify what those are right now, but there are. In source number 13, it's interesting because this is a second version of Otur Ben Atan. Instead of Ashirim, it says Ksherim. Either way, it sounds like Beit Shammai is saying you can only teach very reputable, honorable, exclusive students. And Beit Hillel says you can teach everybody. It means that Beit Hillel is much more democratic. So I just want to pause there for a second. Did anybody here go to an Ivy League school? Where'd you go? Cornell. We count Cornell's. I'm kidding. So would you be in favor in Ivy League schools that they should have open enrollment, anybody who wants to take classes there can go there? Or would you like that it was exclusive and you had to work hard to get in? You don't have to answer. Which means, what would happen if we let everybody into Harvard, everybody into Princeton, everybody... So first of all, the people actually worked hard and paid a lot of money to go there would be very upset. Why are these people allowed in? But my point is, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai have very different approaches. Incidentally, anybody remember an early story about Hillel himself? Do you remember such a story? Or you have no idea what I'm talking about? The snowstorm, the roof. Is it here someplace? Source 15. Torah bonan aniva asher rasher ba in ladin. When the days of judgment come, both the poor and the wealthy, the wicked and so on, will come to judge. La'ani omim lo, v'bnei ma lo osak debetor. If you're really poor, you're going to ask, why didn't you spend your time studying? Im omar ani haya, if I said, because I was poor. V'torad b'monozonotai, I was busy working. Omim lo, klum ani ayiti oter mihilel? Were you poorer than Hillel was? Omor lo val Hillel hazaken, I just want you to pay attention to the turn of phrase, because even if you learned this before, you may not have paid attention to what it says. Omor lo val Hillel hazaken, shebechol yom v'yom haya, ose umistaker be. He would make his coin. He'd give half to the guard by the door to let him in. He couldn't find the money. They didn't let him in. He went and he stood on top of the chimney. Divrei Elokim Chaim. Isn't that interesting that we find that in the middle of this text? He goes to listen to Divrei Elokim Chaim, Mipishmai Vavtalia, and so on and so forth. He ended up passing out in the cold and freezing, and they had to go try to save him, and it was literally a case of Pekuach Nefesh, the Gemara ends up saying. But Hillel was so poor, and he couldn't afford to go to yeshiva every day, so he tried to listen by the windows, tried to listen by the roof, tried to listen by the chimney to get in. So this poor Hillel, you know what he did when he opened up a yeshiva? He said, everybody can come to my yeshiva. You don't have to pay to get into my yeshiva. And you know what Beit Shammai was saying? No, you have to be from a good family. You have to be a tzaddik. You have to be kosher. You have to be decent. And you know what Hillel said? Everybody can come to, I don't care. You want to learn? I'll let you in the door. Now, certain people over here will like the democracy of Beit Hillel. Certain of us are different. And we'll feel that, no, there needs to be, you know, certain standards involved, certainly in terms of higher education. But when it came to voting, do we now realize why they couldn't just follow the majority? Because what's the problem? Who gets to vote? Beit Hillel always had more people. Why did Beit Hillel have more people? Because they let everyone in the door. Shammai was more exclusive. So now how do you vote? Because Beit Shammai would say, sure, we vote, but we can't count any of Beit Hillel because you're not a real school. You're not a real yeshiva. You're not real yeshiva students. We're not counting you. We're only counting Beit Shammai. Nilo sofer otchem. Literally, don't count you. I'll tell you the problem soon, if you want to understand, on a little bit of a deeper level, but that's the problem. If you want to see somebody who actually said it, but I'm saying this is obvious to me, but people only trust rabbis who are no longer with us. I don't know why. In source number 10, the Gemara says, Beit Shammai mechadidi tfei. Beit Shammai was sharper. Beit Shammai was smarter. The Torah Chaim, which for some reason, I don't know why, is an incredibly underrated source. People don't learn the Torah Chaim. You do. You learn it all the time. But that's what happened. The Metifta brings it, and Schottenstein brings it. But I'm saying in yeshivas, nobody uses it. Sure, was his name. No, nobody quotes the Torah Chaim, and he's wonderful. He's wonderful in halacha, and he's wonderful in Agadah. And I'll say it again, it's underrated. I spoke to a number of Rosh Yeshivas who don't use these Gemaras. Never heard of them. Halal Merlach Kamotenu, source 11. Mishum Dekayim Alam, Kol Hecha Depligi Trey Tanai, V'chad Minaya Gadol,
Right?
One side said the law is according to us. Why? Because there's more of us. One side said the law is according to us. Why? Because we're smarter. So each one said the law is according to us. That's exactly the point. Each side said, let's vote. And Beit Hillel said, let's vote. We're more. We won. And Beit Shammai said, let's vote, but we don't include you. We won. So therefore, each side said that we won, and therefore the law is according to us. So the Bat Kol comes out, and that's what's going to be interesting about the Bat Kol. Now, in terms of, yes, me, in terms of precedent. So precedent's going to be interesting, but I just want to, there's a long Yerushalmi in source number 9 that we're not going to read the whole thing, but all of it is important. Because the Yerushalmi tells us some fascinating things. One is it tells us, and by the way, this exists in the Bavli as well, but it's more drawn out in the Yerushalmi in source 9, that they lived in one community. They were able to live together in peace and harmony, which is completely absurd if you realize all the things they argued about. But there was nonetheless, even though they did not respect one another, perhaps on an intellectual level, but they did respect one another in the sense that they lived together in a community, their children married one another, and they were one community. The Gemara says, what are you talking about? They can't eat the same food. They can't, going to one, again, one simple example over here is, when you ever pay attention, like during a chuppah, or like it's only like the rabbi's paying attention. Okay, you got the rabbi, and you got the two eidim. Chatan and Kala don't know what's going on at all. And then you ask for the ring, take the ring, and then you turn to the eidim and you say, is the sheva pruta? Do they ever look at it? Do the eidim have ever gone to school to study values of rings? No. By the way, I always, not always, depends on mood I'm in, I'll say to the Kala, do you want to get it appraised now before we go on? Right? Do you... And if she says yes, okay, anyway. So, what's the argument between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai? One of them says, for argument's sake, that the ring needs to be worth $20. The other says it needs to be worth for $40. I'm approximating right now. So the Gemara says, but that's absurd. How can they live together? Because, you with me now? What happens, one guy goes over and says, Arei Mekudesh Li, and gives a Beit Hillel ring. The other walks over and says, Arei Mekudesh Li, gives a Beit Shammai ring. So according to Beit Hillel, she's married to the first one. According to Beit Shammai, she's not married to the first one, married to the second one. And then she goes, this is a very active girl, and she has a child with each. So according to Beit Hillel, that one's a mamzer. According to Hillel, this one's a mamzer. Gemara says, and how can they live together in one community? They can't decide who's even married to one another. And that's just for starters. There are other examples of that. So the Gemara, the Yerushalmi over here says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's in bold, in the last paragraph in source number 9, HaMalko Mishama B'lo Yimasa Me'olam. God made sure that these theoretical cases never took place. Okay? So if God's looking over you to make sure they can live in one community, that would be very good if God would look over us today so that things would never happen and we would all get along and live in peace and harmony. At the very end, last line in the Yerushalmi, it asks a very funny question, which you will not realize how significant it is until you see the answer. Yerushalmi asks, Be'echan yatzah bat kol, where did the voice come out? So what do you mean, where did the voice come out? Does it make a difference? Did it come out? Do you mean which city did it come out? Did it come out in Bnei Brak, right? In Bnei Brak, they're so frum, they won't listen to a Bat Kol because it's Kol Isha, right? Okay. So did it come out in Yerushalayim? Did it come out? Was it in the Beis Medrash? Was it in the field? Was it in the restaurant? Where did it come? Listen to the answer. Rav Bibi, this is not also before the elections, this is not any support for any candidate. Rav Bibi, Bishem, Rabbi Yochanan Amar, B'Yavne Yotzat Bat Kol, that it came out in Yavne. Ah. Okay, what does that mean, that it came out in Yavne? It's not just a place. It's also a time. It means there's no Sanhedrin sitting in Har HaBayis. It means that there's no longer a real Sanhedrin, so now it's a de facto Sanhedrin. And what do you do with a de facto Sanhedrin? Which means, do the old rules apply? Do they not apply? Or should we decide we're going to use the old rules, which is everything just now got much more complicated when we realize where this Bat Kol came out, which means you ask where, if there's a precedent. Yeah, there's a precedent what they used to do when they had a Beit HaMikdash. Now what do you do when there's no Beit HaMikdash? Because when you had a Beit HaMikdash, who's considered to be part of the Sanhedrin was very, very clear. Now there is no Sanhedrin, so we're just going to count people up. But who do you include? Who has a voice? Who doesn't have a voice? So now you realize the fact that we're in Yavne is a contributing factor to why they couldn't get along. So, I want to move towards a conclusion now. Why is the law like Beit Hillel? So let's go back to source number 1, because the Gemara will ask that question. If both these and these are the words of the living God, or the living words of God, why is the law established like the school of Hillel? And the Gemara gives what looks at first glance like a terrible answer. They were easygoing. They were chilled. They were modest. And they taught both opinions, their own opinion and Beit Shammai's opinion. Not only that, they taught this opinion of Beit Shammai before their own opinion. So no less of an authority, as Rav Yosef Karo says, so what? So what? Just because one side is nice, it means they're right? There are a lot of nice people that are wrong. A lot of nice people that are wrong about a lot of things. Why is this relevant at all? So there's a Tosfot Rid, which is in source 19. It will tell you that because they were nice and because they were easygoing, they taught both opinions. Now, when you teach both opinions, it's not enough for you to say, well, Shammai says this, and we say this, and listen to us. You now are obligated to work harder. You now have to show why your opinion is correct and why the other opinion isn't correct. Which means once you teach something which is opposed to you, you are forced to work harder. And here we get to a point which I think is going to be, you know, quite ironic. Beit Shammai was smarter, but Beit Hillel had a better methodology. Beit Shammai only taught their own approach, and therefore that's all that they considered, all that they contemplated. Beit Hillel taught both opinions, and that made them work harder, and that's why the law is according to them. If you like more mystical interpretations, you can say that modesty is very important in Torah, because the most modest man ever is Moshe Rabbeinu, and halacha is like Moshe Rabbeinu, so therefore maybe there's something else, or you can even say that God gave them a present, and he gave them ideas, and so on. But I'm saying that you have a very rational approach over here from the Tosfot Rid, which is why they were right. But I want to go one step further, and I think that this is emes. What do the Bat Kol say? Elu ve'elu divkim chayim. Both these and these are legitimate approaches. Again, initially we thought it meant both of these are true, and that's where we had what I would call an intellectual quagmire, till we got ourselves out of it, and then we realized it never meant that both sides are true, right? Not every opinion is true. Rather, this is a question of making applications of law and different interpretations, and really what it's telling us is that one can make different interpretations, and both interpretations have validity to it. Shammai made their interpretations, and the school of Hillel made their interpretations. So why is halacha like Beit Hillel? So I'm going to ask you one more time. What did the Bat Kol actually say? It said, Eilu ve'elu divkim chayim. Halacha ke Beit Hillel. Why? Because Beit Hillel believed in Eilu ve'elu divkim chayim. Because Beit Hillel taught both sides. Beit Shammai didn't believe in Eilu ve'elu divkim chayim. They only believed Eilu divkim chayim. They didn't accept, they didn't teach, they didn't contemplate the other side. So how can a Bat Kol that said Eilu ve'elu divkim chayim then possibly say halacha ke Beit Shammai when Beit Shammai didn't believe in that concept? And this, I think, is great musar for all of us. Because all of us have those who we don't like, those who we won't learn, those who we won't teach, and those who we won't read. And they're always on one side of the spectrum. I mean, again, what's interesting about this, I love to ask Yeshiva Bachram, this student, everybody, religious Jews, I want to start off with, I'll ask them this question. First question, there's a follow-up. First question is, do you believe in Eilu ve'elu divkim chayim? What do they always say? Yes. Who is the other Eilu, according to you? It's not the Eilu. Who's your other acceptable Eilu that you disagree with? And you realize people have so much difficulty defining who that other Eilu can possibly be. I mean, if you learn in Panovich today, it's probably not even the other half of Panovich. If unfortunately you know what I'm referring to. And I think that there's a lot of places like this. Again, I don't even know if in Har Hamorah they would say that Merakaz is the other Eilu. I don't know. I don't know. You would hope, but I'm saying I don't know. I mean, I do know that certain svarim that I learn and I think are quite important, rebbeim that I have there are many yeshivas that would not let those svarim into the Beis Medrash. By Soloveitchik, they let them in the Beis Medrash. A lot of places wouldn't. Rav Lichtenstein. Who were they? So it's very interesting. Who we need to ask ourselves that question. Who is the other Eilu that we believe is a valid approach? We don't necessarily agree, and are we learning them? Because if we're not learning them, then how can you possibly say it's not a valid approach? Which means, and if we want the halacha to be like us, the halacha can only be like us if we're learning the other side as well. Otherwise, it's elu d'ilikim chayim. Which means elu ve'elu actually requires a belief in elu ve'elu. And I find that most people who generally will use the term in all their arguments and discussions, they'll use it to say that everything is true, and then they'll discount everything other than what they're saying because they don't believe that anything else is true, which means ultimately they don't really believe in elu ve'elu d'ilikim chayim. Kodesh Baruch Hu should give us insight, should give us wisdom, should come in and micromanage our situations that we don't get into real fights and we're able to avoid real difficulties, but he should give us the greatness of mind and of spirit that we can learn other approaches, but also the greatness of spirit that we can figure out what is the proper halacha and God should save us from mistakes. Thank you. Correct, correct. Let me comment on that. Correct. Let me comment on that. First of all, I think people overstate the closeness of the Rebbe and Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's one. I was in Rabbi Soloveitchik's shir and I heard him talk about the Rebbe and I heard him talk about Chabad. And I'm not saying there were negative things. I just think people are overstating the closeness. I think that for people that were supposedly very close friends, they had no contact for many, many, many years. Secondly, which is overstated, is the Rebbe's learning in Berlin. He was only there for a very, very brief amount of time. He sat in some classes. But Rabbi Soloveitchik did say, he said he sat there in class with Mishnayos open, and he said that he always was learning Mishnayos and listening with one ear, and he said the Rebbe had the best grades. That's what he said. Okay, now, let me say something else, which I heard from Rav Schechter. Once I quoted this, and there was a rabbi in the audience who yelled at me and said, it's impossible, it never happened, and it's not true, except I heard Rav Schechter say it, and he wrote it in a book, so what can I do? So apparently it's true. And I heard him say it more than once. So, and it goes along the lines of what you said. But one more thing about Rabbi Soloveitchik. He was not a great posek in the sense that he would respond depending how you ask the question. If you would say, so what does Judaism say about something, then he could be very, very broad. If he would say, what should I do in that situation, maybe different. Rabbi Soloveitchik was too complex as a thinker to be a really good posek. So we'll just leave it at that. And I also, by the way, in terms of in vitro fertilization, Rabbi Soloveitchik for many years said, I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know what halacha says about this because it is a new case. I don't know what to say. But I will tell you a story about abortion. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach believed that abortion was murder unless the mother's life is in danger. It is not a universal opinion. There are those who disagree with this, and I know that somehow in Judaism that is a louder voice, but nonetheless, it wasn't the only voice. There was a great rabbi in Jerusalem, Rabbi Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who believed that abortions can be done certainly in cases where the child or the fetus is going to be in, I'll give you an example, a Tay-Sachs baby. Rav Moshe said you cannot do an abortion on a Tay-Sachs baby and it has to carry full term because it's murder, because the mother's life is not in danger, and Rav Waldenberg felt it was allowed. Okay, just pause there for a moment. This is the story that Rav Schechter told. A physician who had studied with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was approached by a woman who was in her early 40s, pregnant for the first time, and then she was told that there was some serious damage to the fetus, and the doctor had encouraged her to get an abortion, and she turned to this religious doctor, and she said to a doctor, what does Judaism say? Which, by the way, the biggest mistake doctors can make then is to paskan halacha, and he didn't. I mean, I had to deal with the doctors, at least in my neighborhood. I tell them, I'll paskan halacha and you decide medicine, right? Medical questions I'll send to you, but halacha questions I'll decide upon. And if halacha questions need his medical knowledge, I will turn to you. I will defer to you. But I once had a case. I'm sorry, I'll get back to the story. Keep you hanging for a moment. I once had a question. Somebody came to me on Shabbos morning and said, I was in a car accident yesterday, a man in his late 50s, and said, I'm having chest pains right now. So I said, well, there's a doctor right there. Just quickly talk to him, and then we'll continue. I said, say, you know, get to the house. So the doctor looks at him and whatever and says, well, most likely we're wearing a seatbelt. Yeah, most likely the seatbelt hit you right over here, and it's a muscle, and therefore you're fine. Maybe after Shabbos still hurts, go to the hospital. So he comes back to me. I said, what did he say? So he said, oh, I don't have to go to the hospital. So I go to this doctor. I say, you told him not to go to the hospital? Yeah. I said, what would you have told him if it was Tuesday? He said, I would have told him to go to the hospital, but it's Shabbos. I said, so you just paskened on Shabbos. I didn't ask you. I want to know if a guy was having a heart attack right now. That's why I told you to look at him. I didn't tell you to look at him to paskan halacha for me. If you would have told him to go to hospital on Tuesday, you go to the hospital on Shabbos as well. That's what the lacha is. So doctors have to stay away from paskening. So this doctor calls up Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who he studied medical ethics with, and he says, Rabbi, a woman approached me, and such is the case, her life is not in danger, and the doctor said she should get an abortion because of potential damage to the fetus, and what should I tell her? And Shlomo Zalman said, we learned this together. You know my opinion. You know that I think that it's murder, and she can't have an abortion. So the doctor had a little bit of chutzpah, which is okay. It's okay to have chutzpah. And he said to Rav Shlomo Zalman, what do you think about it? And I'll call you back tomorrow. So Rav Shlomo Zalman's probably thinking to himself, I don't know if any of you have met him. I mean, I have, and I spoke to him. And he was a very unassuming, very nice, but very smart man. And he's probably thinking to himself, okay, this has been my opinion for the last 60 years. It's not going to change overnight. So he says, sure, you want to call me back, call me back. Because again, he really was nice and unassuming. So he calls him back the next day, and Shlomo Zalman says, you know what, I thought about it. She's not my student. She didn't ask my opinion. She didn't ask psak from me. She wants to know, what does Judaism say about this? So he says, tell her there's a really great rabbi who lives in Jerusalem. His name is Rav Waldenberg, and Rav Waldenberg says that you're allowed to get an abortion in such a situation. The kachahaya. Can you imagine a pro-life person talking about a pro-choice person, pro-choice, pro-life? I mean, they're killing one another. And this is Eilav Eilav Divuk Mekayim. This is respecting another opinion and saying, this is part of Judaism, this is part of the Mesorah, this is how he applies the halacha, this is how he applies the sources, and it's the same thing that you wanted to say, and I agree with you 100%, and there should be more people that listen to one another, study one another, and respect one another. We'd probably be in a much better situation. Thank you very much.